You intuit that. You know that you are basically not reason. You are basically not mind. Some of you say, I would like to get away from all this reasoning and mind. You are basically will. And then he took another step and he said, no puns on the fact that we have a student named Will in the class. Now stop that. You know that you're basically willpower, and the world is as well. Say, why has the world got to be like me? Well, by analogy. Now, this is an interesting thing. Schopenhauer, because of his more mystical and anti-rational approach, he's very pessimistic about reason. Schopenhauer believed that sometimes you write things and people are just going to recognize that, oh, that's the way to put what I have been feeling. Haven't you all had that experience? I have, many times. In fact, as a person who sometimes is a writer, I really appreciate it when I run across somebody. That's why I particularly like Jones' History of Philosophy and so forth. Many times you read what somebody else has to say and say, that's such a better summary than what I could have given. Boy, that is great. Well, it's not just like a teacher who wants to find the nice summary of something. Sometimes you have an experience or there's a particular historical event and somebody writes it up and you go, yeah, that's the way to put it. I can identify. That was my experience too. I really enjoyed going to Hawaii. I went on vacation with my boys. And if I were to write up, you know, what I did on summer vacation, it'd probably come out fairly dull and say, well, we saw this and we did that and so forth. But then sometimes you read somebody that's a travel writer, you know, and they talk about the experience of Hawaii and say, that's the way to put it. That's the experience I had. That's the way I felt when I was in Hawaii. Now, do you all know what I'm getting at? When someone gives expression to a feeling that you've had, an experience you've had, well, Schopenhauer expected that when he told people, you know, the world as a whole is will, that they'd have that kind of experience. He wasn't going to reason them to that. Why would he do that? He doesn't trust reason. He's pessimistic about reason. But when he expresses his experience, he thinks others are going to go, oh, yeah, that's right. So when we sit here, and by the way, I'm still going to do it. I'm going to reassert my rational prerogative to criticize this. But when you sit there saying, now, wait a minute, how can you assert this? You don't believe in reason. You have to understand, given his theory, he didn't think he was reasoning to this conclusion. He thought he was just giving expression to it, and others would identify with it. So he started with our direct experience of ourselves. We intuit ourselves as will. And by analogy, he said, the whole world is will, and he expected everyone would recognize upon presentation that in fact there is this community of feeling, community of will, that's part of everything in the world. All right, so to put it all together, what we've learned thus far from Schopenhauer is that we have an intuition of ourselves and of ultimate reality, that it's will. That's basically it. What's the problem? Problem is that reality is will, assertion, desire, drive. That's what I am. But I feel frustration. My will is frustrated. I feel restlessness and a lack of satisfaction. What, do you ever feel lack of satisfaction? Maybe you're not old enough to have that experience. But Schopenhauer said, you know, because we are basically a drive, a willpower, there are things we want. And what happens when we get them? Then we're really not fascinated by them anymore and they don't appeal to us. Maybe they aren't repulsive, although that happens too. There is in human experience. We want something so bad, and when we finally get it, we hate it. But it's not just that. It's that sometimes when we get the things we want, they no longer attract us. And so everybody has this experience of ennui. You know, it's just kind of like, well, what will I do? Where am I going? What am I living for? Everything that I get doesn't satisfy me. So I move from one desire that is fulfilled and then I'm unsatisfied to another desire which is fulfilled and I'm unsatisfied. And why is that? Because, you see, you never arrive if what you are is basically will. And if what reality is basically will, every time you get to a place that you think is the terminus, there's more will shoving you on, desiring more, driving you beyond it. And so we have frustration and restlessness and lack of satisfaction because will is never quenched. Desiring is never quenched. How can man be saved then? And Schopenhauer's answer is twofold. First, man is saved in aesthetics. And then secondly, man is saved in asceticism. I know they sound somewhat alike, but we will distinguish them. Aesthetics, the savoring of art, experience rendered artistically. But then that will drive Schopenhauer to asceticism, salvation through self-denial. Let's see both of these steps. First of all, salvation in aesthetics. According to Schopenhauer, art is the only place where man may momentarily escape being subject to will. When I am in the attitude of aesthetic contemplation, that's the only respite I have in all my life from that driving will that's in me. I can momentarily escape. Remember I told you life is basically we're driven. We choose, decide, we will. We aim for this and then we aim for something else and we aim for something else. We just keep... But sometimes we stop and we smell the roses. Pardon me, but I think that's an appropriate use here. Sometimes we just pull back and we savor something in aesthetic appreciation. So someone paints a picture and you're in the museum there, and again, I'm telling you bits and pieces wise, we can identify with what many of these philosophers say. I remember being in the National Gallery in London last year and some of the greatest works of art that men have ever done there, and you just stand there and it's like you've lost time and space. You're just kind of communing with this picture. Now, there are people who will make fun of that. I don't care. I know what that experience is to say, wow. And momentarily, in the attitude of aesthetic contemplation, I'm no longer driven. I'm no longer pushed. I'm no longer will. I'm momentarily pulled out of, if you will, the hustle and bustle of life. According to Schopenhauer, works of art give us a more adequate insight into the nature of things than rational scientific theories do. I don't agree with him here, but I can argue for him. I can try to make a case as a lawyer for him. There's a sense in which you can get at that. I've already told you that if somebody just analyzes the filet mignon you're eating in terms of its chemical components and where it came from and how it's prepared, is that an adequate, you know, rendering of the experience? No. In the same way, Schopenhauer thinks when you look at a work of art in the aesthetic attitude of contemplation, you get closer to the nature of things than when someone gives you a scientific analysis. So, let's say I'm looking at a landscape painting. Let's say the landscape includes a rushing river. And I contemplate that, and I say, yeah, I know that feeling. Somebody comes along and says, by the way, did you know that the water there is hydrogen and oxygen in this pattern, H2O? And in fact, I could give you the dynamics and the formulas for the way in which the water is rushing down here and why the shore is being, you know, eaten away at this percentage of soil every day and so forth. And so, you know, he writes it all out and says, so what do you think? Now, So I've got the formulas here, chemical and physical. I've got formulas, and I've got the picture. I'll let you choose. Which is the more adequate representation of reality? Schopenhauer says, artistic contemplation gets you closer to the truth than rational scientific formulas. Aesthetic contemplation is not practical, and that's its glory. Have you ever heard people say that the reason you engage in art is for art's sake? Art exists for its own sake. I remember the first time I encountered that when I was in college. I think I sneered, probably. If I didn't outwardly, inwardly, then, oh, what a bunch of pompous nonsense. The reason for art is art itself. Well, I still don't agree with that, but I now have a better understanding of why people like Schopenhauer would say that. Aesthetic contemplation is not a means to an end. Aesthetic contemplation is the end. It's an end in itself. We don't study art so that we can go out there and build better bridges. Okay? Oh, now I understand how rivers, you know, operate, so I can build a better bridge over this river. No, it's nothing like that. We study art not to be practical, but simply to contemplate the art. By the way, I said earlier that Schopenhauer tended to be something of a snob. Well, this fits in with his snobbery because as far as he's concerned, the only people who really can do that are the cultivated elite. You know, your blue-collar worker out here, he doesn't go to the museum on weekends to engage in aesthetic contemplation. You know, but you grow up in a family where you go to the operas and to the museums and to presentations of works of art and so forth. And those people, you see, are in a favored position to get closer to reality. Anyway, so long as you are submerged in the beauty of the work of art, you're released from the pressure of will and the pressure of reason. You don't sit there thinking, boy, I better get a formula that can account for this. I need concepts that can account for this beautiful landscape. No, you just have a direct experience and you savor it, you appreciate it. Art teases us out of thought and puts us into a mental state where our desire, our pursuits are temporarily stilled. Okay, so the first step towards salvation from this unquenchable will that keeps driving us and driving us is aesthetic contemplation, works of art appreciated in an impractical or non-practical mindset. But what did I just say? That's temporary. So that's not going to do the full job of saving man, is it? The more permanent solution to the unquenchable desiring of will, which is the ultimate reality for man, the more permanent solution is ascetic or mystical salvation. Somebody might say, well, Schopenhauer, I've got an answer for you. If this driving will is what is the source of our frustration and ennui and lack of satisfaction, I'll tell you how we can get rid of driving will. Kill yourself. And Schopenhauer had to deal with that. Is suicide our salvation then? Do we finally, you know, get rid of the driving power of will by killing it? Will suicide be our salvation? This is not terribly convincing, but Schopenhauer argued, if you stop and think about this distinction between phenomenal and noumenal, you'll see that suicide cannot be the answer. Why? Well, when we look at ourselves in terms of a phenomena, what appears to us is that we are distinct from one another, right? But that's not ultimate reality, that's just mere appearance. We're not really distinct, we're all part of this universal will. So, by killing myself, the illusion of me as an individual, I haven't killed will, have I? I've just killed the phenomenal appearance that I'm a separate piece of will. And so, will, the driving, irrational force that is reality is still there even though I commit suicide. And so Schopenhauer said we have to have another answer. Now, I just want to say real quickly, just so you can see the inadequacy of that, well, yeah, maybe killing myself doesn't kill reality as a whole, the driving will, but it does kill what? My experience as a separate entity subject to will. So will is going to go on. It's still going to have this unsatisfied drive in it. But it isn't going to be me feeling that drive anymore. I'll be dead. Well, that's the comeback, I think, to his answer. But from his standpoint, he said, no, you're just killing a phenomena here. You're just killing an appearance. You haven't dealt with will. Rather, we need to get beyond this and realize that the multiplicity of our private selves, the multiplicity of our private individual wills, is an illusion. And when we realize that, stop and think about this, when you realize that you are not really a separate will, that's just an illusion, that's a phenomena, but you really aren't separate, then all of a sudden you don't need to be driven to satisfy your desire. Because if you're not a separate entity, then you don't have a separate desire, do you? And if you aren't a separate entity, and therefore you don't really have a separate desire from the whole of reality with its driving will, then you're not different from the other people out there in the hustle and bustle of life that are apparently driven by desire and will. In fact, you can now live a life characterized not by pushing for the satisfaction of your desires, but characterized by equality and a recognition of the unity of all things. What's the line in the Beatles song? You are me and we are all together, right? When you realize that, then I no longer try to satisfy my desire over against you. Whether it's economic, in terms of military power, property power, sexual power, anything. I don't assert myself at all, because we're all together. And that doesn't mean we're all together because all these individual wills are all in one room, are all part of one club or one, you know, goal or purpose. You are me, and I am you, and we are all together. And when you realize that, what has happened? Will has now been slain. The recognition that we are all one permanently quiets the will. It permanently quiets it because now there's no other against which to will. Now don't pretend that this isn't a one understandable and somewhat attractive thought. I lived through the 60s in the counterculture and the influence of Eastern thought, and many people thought this is the answer. We don't have to defend it rationally, but we all have this direct feeling that we're all one. So stop being greedy capitalists. Stop fighting the war in Vietnam. Stop being, you know, people that hate other races and discriminating and so forth. But don't you understand? We're all one. Schopenhauer was writing in the 19th century. He was the first hippie. I'm telling you, well, not really a hippie because he was borrowing this, and the hippies were borrowing it too. Where did he get this? From Eastern Hinduism. He said, the ancient Hindus realized that we are all basically one. And he said, that ancient wisdom, that ancient insight, if you will, has come to expression in various ways in all the different religions of the world. All the religions of the world endorse sympathy. Notice that? Sympathy, sympathos, to feel with the other person. Sympathy, pity, and self-renunciation. You should underline the word self in that expression. Self-renunciation. Well, self-renunciation means asceticism, putting death to your desires. And now you don't try to satisfy your body or live for sensuality or for money or for fame or whatever it is. You rather humbly withdraw, deny yourself, live in sympathy for other people. And according to Schopenhauer, all religions of the world have that message in one form or another, and they're all expressing ancient Hinduism in the view that we are all one. Now, just an interesting application of this. Since the salvation from frustration and restlessness and lack of satisfaction comes permanently in that mystical awareness that we are all one, which leads me to an ascetic, self-denying lifestyle, Schopenhauer said the first mark of sainthood, asceticism, is seen in a voluntary and complete chastity. Voluntary and complete chastity. You choose complete chastity. You never engage in sexual pleasure. All right, you all know enough biology. What would it mean if everybody got saved? If everybody became a saint and engaged in asceticism that denies all sexual pleasure? It would mean the extinction of the human race. Now, you think I'm leading up to a criticism in that? No, he said that's exactly right. That's how we're going to kill that driving, irrational will. The whole human race will commit suicide. I don't need help in criticizing this right now, so just wait. You need to appreciate where his thinking is going. Now, you have to ask yourself, though, a moment ago we were just told that the extinction of one individual is really just dealing with phenomena, and the noumenal reality, ultimate reality of will, is not, you know, going to be done away with just because you are gone. Well, don't we want to ask that question over again? Well, if the whole human race is gone, why is ultimate reality no longer will? Now, I'm not sure on his own terms that Schopenhauer is really satisfied the difficulty that he has raised. But anyway, you now understand his view. Reason, he's pessimistic about. Reality is irrational will. Salvation can be found in art momentarily, ascetic contemplation, but ultimately it has to come through ascetic and mystical salvation, where you realize, in the good Hindu sense, we are all one. I'd like to read a couple of representative quotes from Schopenhauer for you. Schopenhauer says that when we get to the level of sympathy and pity for others, when we attain the sainthood of renunciation, a man like that no longer makes the egotistical distinction between his person and that of others, but takes as much interest in the sufferings of other individuals as in his own, and therefore is not only benevolent in the highest degree, but even ready to sacrifice his own individuality whenever such a sacrifice will save a number of other persons. Then it clearly follows that such a man, who recognizes in all beings his own inmost and true self, must also regard the infinite suffering of all suffering beings as his own and take on himself the pain of the whole world. Knowledge of the whole, of the nature of the thing in itself, which has been described, becomes a quieter of all and every volition. The will now turns away from life. It now shudders at the pleasures in which it recognizes the assertion of life. Man now attains to the state of voluntary renunciation, resignation, true indifference, and perfect will-lessness. The phenomenon by which this change is marked is the transition from virtue to asceticism. And then I'll skip a bit. He says, voluntary and complete chastity is the first step in asceticism, or the denial of the will to live. Pull back for a second and think about that last line. The denial of the will to live. Is that what Western humanistic philosophy finally brings us to? Here's the answer to Kant and all these intellectual problems. Assert that the world is not mind, it's will. And the only way we can be saved is to what? Renounce the will to live. Pretty sad. Pretty pessimistic. From a religious standpoint, he says, what I have here described with feeble tongue and only in general terms is no philosophical fable invented by myself and only of today. No, it was the enviable, pardon me, life of so many saints and beautiful souls among Christians, and still more among Hindus and Buddhists, and also among the believers of other religions. However different were the dogmas impressed on their reason, the same inward, direct, intuitive knowledge from which alone all virtue and holiness proceed expressed itself in precisely the same way in the conduct of life. For here also the great distinction between intuitive and abstract knowledge shows itself. Think back to what I told you about Rousseau. Rousseau the Romantic, his view of religion, we all have a certain feeling, religious feeling, but that comes to rational, linguistic expression in different ways. But behind all the differences of the creeds, you have the same experience. The things that are troubling the Christian church today and our culture today were planted way back in the early 1800s and late 1700s. Because this is exactly what religious liberalism is in our day and beyond, where people will tell us, well, all religions are basically one. They say it in different ways, but what's underneath it is the same. Schopenhauer was asserting that. He goes, well, if you use reason, you come up with these different religions and creeds. But behind them all, he said, behind all this abstract presentation is the same conduct of life, the ascetic, self-denying, sympathetic, humble form of life. He said there's a wide gulf between the two, between intuitive and abstract knowledge, which can only be crossed by the aid of philosophy as regards the knowledge of the nature of the world. Intuitively, or in concrete, every man is really conscious of all philosophical truths, but to bring them to abstract knowledge, to reflection, is the work of philosophy. Thus it may be that the inner nature of holiness, self-renunciation, mortification of our own will, asceticism, is here for the first time expressed abstractly and free from all mythical elements as denial of the will to live, appearing after the complete knowledge of its own nature has become a quieter of all volition. On the other hand, it has been known directly and realized in practice by saints and ascetics who had all the same inward knowledge, though they use very different language with regard to it, according to the dogmas which their reason had accepted, and in consequence of which an Indian, a Christian, or a Lama saint must each give a very different account of his conduct. He said, a saint may be full of the absurdest superstition, or on the contrary, he may be a philosopher. It is all the same. Want to write that one down? That's a great one to capture what this guy's saying. A saint may be full of the absurdest superstition, or on the contrary, he may be a philosopher. It is all the same. Wow. So Schopenhauer says, you don't need my philosophy. My philosophy may be giving sophisticated expression, but this truth, if you can call it a truth, this experience was known by the Hindus, the ancient Hindus, by the Christian mystics, by the Buddhists, by all these other religions. And they expressed it in crude, superstitious absurdities. But what they were saying is really what I am saying. It's all the same. No matter what your rational linguistic presentation is, the underlying experience is the same. We are all one. All right, I have some criticisms I'm going to make of Schopenhauer, but let me just see if you have any questions at this point. Do you understand what he's getting at? Even if you don't want to believe this, do you find a certain attractiveness to it? At least it nicely fits together, doesn't it? It's kind of a clever system of thought. But of course, as a system of thought, it's not really all that helpful. It's just putting out there in a way that hopefully you'll recognize the direct experience you all have, that we're not different from each other. We're all part of the same reality. Yes, sir?
Well, you said earlier that the ultimate reality of the world is real, and you changed that by a false analogy. And then you said later that you believe in a universal will. But to me, that seems consistent, and I wonder what you meant by false analogy getting to a universal will.
Well, how do you get to the universal will? He said what you directly intuit is yourself individually as driven, driven, driven. You are will. Yeah, well, why does that... Why, when I look out the window, should I say, oh, yeah, and the trees are like that, too? He said, well, because all of reality must be like me. And I'm saying, why? That seems to me an arbitrary and false analogy.
You're speaking in terms of all of reality.
Yeah, if the way in which I know things is by direct experience, I'm just trying to be a good Schopenhauerite now. If I'm going to say, what do I intuit? Well, I don't experience the willpower of trees and rocks and seas and so forth. But I do experience my own will. And so it had to be by analogy that he argued it. But in the end, he didn't expect that to convince. Now, it's not like, now follow me rationally. Premise one, analogy, conclusion. It was rather, after you do this analogy, he hoped that we'd all stand back and go, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I've had that feeling too. Tim? He thought that causal analysis was part of the confused thinking of perception. I'm sorry? Well, not so much a result of his mysticism. It's like two sides of the same coin. He remembered derogates reason. He has a pessimistic view of reason. Well, that's the other side of the coin, that he has a very high view of intuition and mysticism. Okay? No, it's objectification through the subject. Objectification and then will is coming to an objective expression in the individual objects out there that are called human beings and trees and rocks and seas as well, for that matter, just at different levels. Mm-hmm. Through subjects that universal will has been objectified. The word objectification is the correct English translation of the German there. It was Hegel said too, mind, universal mind, Weltgeist, objectifies itself through the subject of thinking, the individual. Right, it objectifies itself, object in reference to the universal, but subjective with reference to the individual. That's okay. Now, the reason I'm going to take a little bit more time than I'm going to give to the Romantics and to Kierkegaard and others to criticize Schopenhauer is because I consider this one of the major, this kind of thinking, whether it's, you know, universal will that you're talking about, but this kind of thinking that is defended in a mystical way and so forth, I consider one of the major pitfalls of Western culture and Eastern culture for that matter too. And so, though it's going to come up over and over again, I don't want to have to keep going back and saying no, 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 no to this. I'm going to give you one long explanation of why the word is no to this kind of philosophy. And then I'll just expect you to apply it over and over again. First criticism of Schopenhauer, how could he know that perceptual experiences of the body and intuitive experiences of the will were experiences of the same thing, but experienced in two ways, rather than experiences of two different things? So we have a basically logical or epistemological problem in Schopenhauer that I don't think he can get beyond. I'm going to put this on the board so I can make it real clear to you. According to Schopenhauer, there are two things. Remember phenomenal, noumenal? There are two things. One is the perceptual experience of the body. Okay, so when I perceptually experience myself, I come up with what? Arms and legs, head, nose, teeth, so forth. Perceptually, I think what of myself? I'm a body. But as you know, that's confused thinking. What do I intuit myself to be? Intuition tells me I am a will. And that is the direct, savored, unmediated reality. I am will. And according to Schopenhauer, these are really different routes to the same thing. The intuitive is the correct one. Since the intuitive is the correct one, basically he's saying you have one reality, which is will, and two ways of looking at it, or approaching it. And those two ways are perception and intuition. I'm just trying to schematize for you the way Schopenhauer sees this. He says you have one reality, an ultimate reality, that is encountered two ways, perceptually and intuitively. The perceptual way of doing it, confusedly, calls it body. The intuitive is the correct way. Now, the only question I'm asking, and this is analysis, I'm not just standing outside throwing rocks saying you're wrong. I'm just saying, well, but now, even within your system of thought, how could you know that these are two ways of experiencing the same thing rather than experiences of two different things?
That is, why is it this way, that you have body, perception experiences one kind of reality, intuition experiences a different reality. See, in terms of what I put on the board here, you've got two ways of looking at it. One is you have two routes to the same reality, and the other is these two routes lead to separate realities.
We're inclined to think of will and body as two different things, not the same thing looked at differently. You all understand what I'm saying? How can Schopenhauer answer that question? Well, he can't. He doesn't have any argument one way or another. He just takes it for granted. Well, perception and intuition are looking at the same reality, and one distorts it and the other gets it right. Why don't you say there's two realities? Secondly, what ground is there, what warrant is there for holding that the experience that we call will is more real or more reliable than the experience we call body? My first criticism is he hasn't really shown that there's only one thing seen in two ways. But even if he had, the question is, why should we say seeing it in the intuitive way is more accurate and adequate than seeing it in the perceptual body way? Why is intuition thought to be more real and reliable than perception? There's a second arbitrary element that destroys his system. Thirdly, and why should we believe, even if there's but one reality, and if that one reality is more reliably called will rather than body, why should we believe that everything else, reality as a whole, is likewise will? Now, this criticism you've heard previously, but I'm putting it here now in my structured refutation. Schopenhauer is arbitrary that there's one reality seen two ways. Secondly, he's arbitrary that the intuitive is the more reliable. And thirdly, he hasn't given us any good reason to believe that everything is will, all of reality, and not just us as human beings. Fourthly, his philosophy is seen to be arbitrary and inconsistent. I said a few moments ago, why should we think that the extinction of the human race would mean that universal will vanishes? That's just arbitrary or inconsistent. If reality is will, it's not going to vanish just because the human race stops willing. Reality will still be will. The arbitrariness and inconsistency is seen also in that Schopenhauer says if individuality is an illusion, so that we are really all one, then we should be sympathetic rather than cruel to one another. Now, when I said all that, you all, like meek little lambs, you know, nodded your heads, went along with that. Just like people in our culture think, well, Hinduism, monism, if we're all one, then that means don't be greedy, don't be cruel, don't be selfish, right? Think about it. If we are living in an illusion that there are differences between us, then it's also an illusion that I'm being cruel when I prefer my pleasures over yours. Here's the irony. If you are a Hindu, that could as reasonably lead to cruel behavior as it could lead to sympathetic behavior. Why not indulge in all the pleasure you want? It's all illusion anyway. When it looks like, okay, let's just take a really gross illustration. Pardon me for that, but it will make the point. A man who wants to get his sexual pleasure through rape is the epitome of the man who is cruel and selfish, right? Our culture would all recognize that, and I think that's true. But think about it. The Hindu comes along and says, if he just realized that we are all one, he would not impose his desire, his pleasure, upon another individual. Well, here's the sad answer to that from within the non-Christian's worldview. He's not imposing his will on someone else because there is no separate will. What appears to be the cruel misuse of a woman turns out to be her pleasure, actually. Isn't that a pathetic, horrible way to think? But Hinduism allows you to go either way, doesn't it? Because he's not imposing his will on another. We're all one. So that was really her will, too. And so it's a Western philosopher, Schopenhauer, that we're refuting here. But I'm also refuting all of Eastern thought here in mysticism when it says when you move from the oneness of things, here's the way you should live your life. You can always go the opposite way with equally good reason. If you're a monist, why should we deny the body rather than indulging the body in its pleasures if you're a monist? If you're a monist, why not indulge? And so my fourth criticism that Schopenhauer is arbitrary and inconsistent. What we have seen is that just about every step along the way in his philosophy, he has been arbitrary in his preferences. He's only giving us his own chosen presuppositions and perspective. He's not giving us any reason to believe what he has said. And then my fifth criticism, which is the problem with all mysticism, is this. Schopenhauer's philosophy is communicated in abstract concepts, and yet he held the conceptual knowledge is disdainful because it distorts and misleads us. Well, you know, you can't have it all, can you? Can't have your cake and eat it too. If he's going to present his philosophy conceptually in abstract concepts, and he's going to say all abstract concepts distort, then his philosophy is distorting, isn't it? On the other hand, if he says, well, my philosophy was never meant to convince you, I was just laying something out there that you were supposed to intuit to be true. Well, but then his view cannot be successfully communicated in conceptual form. So either he expects us to intuit it, in which case he shouldn't be conceptually expressing it. He can't communicate what he wants us to intuit. We have to intuit it, after all. Or he gives it conceptually, he communicates this, but it has to then be a distortion, leads us away from the truth. To put it very simply, from within his worldview, why does he even go beyond intuition as an experience of these alleged truths? Why does he write philosophy at all? Why doesn't he just engage in poetry and mythology? Because he said the absurdist superstitions and philosophy are all one. It makes no difference. Well, then why do the philosophy route at all? And of course, people in the 60s loved that. Why go to university? Why get good grades? Why be scholarly? Hey, we're all in tune with Mother Nature. And that's what's really important. You don't have to think about this. You just have to feel it. Well, Schopenhauer, if you want to endorse that, then why are you writing philosophy books? And so here's the paradox. It's the paradox of all mysticism. Given the nature of reality that intuition discloses, a rational account of the experience is impossible. A rational account, a conceptual account, is impossible. After all, the intuitive insight transcends conceptual analysis. Well, if that's true, then here's the bottom line. If Schopenhauer, or you can put in there any mystic, if Schopenhauer is correct, he cannot know that he is correct. Because knowledge is conceptual. That is, if he's correct based on intuition, he can never have conceptual assurance that he is. He cannot communicate that, nor can he even to himself know, that is rationally or conceptually, that he's correct. And so every attempt to assert that this is right rather than that is a violation of his own intuitive mystical insight. Well, that's the ultimate refutation, is when a man's own philosophy says you cannot know that this is true. We're left with feeling, and you can't even, if you're going to be fully consistent, you can't even rationally communicate this feeling is correct. All you can do is feel, intuit. And so it's the death of not only the human race and the will to live, it's the death of all rationality and knowledge, this mystical intuitive approach of Schopenhauer and everybody else that comes down the line. Like I say, we're not going to be done with mysticism when we move on from Schopenhauer. It's going to keep coming back, keep coming. I've already said in the 1960s we had a big wave of the mystical approach. But whether with Schopenhauer or today, the critique that I've given you in these steps is all going to come back over and over again. Please bear it in mind. I don't want to have to repeat it.